Imagine you're sitting at your dining table, right? You're deeply invested in this sprawling tabletop role-playing game.
Oh, yeah, like you've spent weeks on it.
Exactly. Weeks. You're meticulously painting these tiny plastic miniatures, drafting up complex lore, drawing out maps on graph paper.
Really putting in the hours.
Right. And then you stepped away to grab a glass of water, just for a second.
Okay.
But when you return, the miniature of the Paladin hasn't just been bumped. It has deliberately moved an inch to the left.
Oh, man. That is, yeah, that's creepy.
Right. But you brush it off. You say, oh, it's just my imagination.
Yeah.
But the next night, it's moved again.
And you definitely didn't touch it.
You didn't touch it. And then as you lean in close to the board, you hear this unmistakable microscopic sound of steel clashing against steel.
Yeah, that's the moment your stomach just completely drops.
Exactly. The boundary between you, the creator, and the universe you thought you were merely simulating it has just completely collapsed.
And that collapse is the exact psychological terror at the heart of the source material we are examining today.
Yes, it really is.
Because you aren't just rolling dice anymore, you know? You are a participant in an ecosystem that is suddenly demanding accountability for your imagination.
Okay, let's unpack this because we are jumping right into that exact feeling today.
I'm ready.
The mission of this deep dive is to dissect the mechanics of how two completely different realities are bleeding into one another.
Which is just, it's such a wild
It
concept.
is. You've got the incredibly mundane 1980s suburban sprawl of Ainington on one side.
Just total, normal, boring suburbia.
Right. And on the other side, the magical, completely lethal realm of Murari.
Yeah.
And we aren't just looking at the timeline of events here, because you, the listener, you already know the story.
Right.
We're going to analyze the underlying physics of this overlap.
Which is where it gets really fun.
Exactly. Like,
Yes.
how do belief, context, and sheer human stubbornness rewrite the rules of reality?
Yeah, because when you look closely at how these characters handle that ontological shock, that collision of two worlds, it fundamentally changes how we understand the concept of value.
Yes. Value is such a huge part of this.
It forces us to ask whether meaning is an inherent property of an object, or if it is entirely assigned by the environment it sits in.
Right, the context.
Exactly. So let's look at the baseline economics of this reality bleed, starting with Eleanor's kitchen habits.
Oh, the silverware scene.
The silverware scene, she is standing at a sink in a house with, you know, linoleum floors and those cheap wood grain cabinets.
Totally standard 1980s kitchen.
Right. And she's just casually washing this heavy, incredibly ornate silver from House October.
Which she calls Ruritania, just to cover up the Murari connection.
Yeah, her little cover story. And Tom, who is watching her, is completely paralyzed by this.
Because to his suburban American mindset,
Yeah.
you do not use museum-quality heirloom silver on a random Tuesday.
Right. You lock it away.
You lock it up for Thanksgiving or like a wedding.
Exactly. Tom is operating on a scarcity mindset. He assumes that rarity dictates utility.
But Eleanor's philosophy is the exact opposite of that. She argues that beautiful things are meant to be used, and that locking them in a box just renders them entirely useless.
Which is such a fundamentally fey way of looking at it.
Yeah, but it's not just a quirky fey habit, right? It's a radically different economic theory.
Oh, absolutely.
She is basically domesticating her own extraordinary reality by treating it as mundane.
I love that phrasing, domesticating reality. And what's fascinating here is that contextual valuation flows in both
Right,
directions.
not just a one-way street.
Not at all. Consider how Agatha approaches the supernatural later on.
Oh, Agatha's the best.
She really is. When she marches into the Ainington drugstore with her summer savings, she isn't buying a sword. She's not buying a mystical talisman.
No, she is buying a basic, completely manual Kodak camera.
Right, a camera, an instruction book, and a roll of color film from this totally unenthusiastic teenage clerk.
Because she needs an quote-unquote opticon to photograph fairies.
Exactly. She's treating this piece of human technology like a magical artifact.
It's like a cultural exchange program where the currency rates are just totally mismatched, you know?
That's a great analogy.
To Tom, an everyday Murari fork is a priceless heirloom. But to Agatha, a mass-produced piece of plastic and glass is a magical tool.
It is, though I do want to look a bit closer at Agatha's logic there.
Sure.
It's tempting to call her brilliant for weaponizing an ordinary piece of 1980s tech against the supernatural.
I mean, it seems pretty smart.
It does, but is she actually being brilliant or is she making a massive, incredibly arrogant assumption?
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, she is assuming that fey magic, this ancient reality-bending force, is bound by the physical laws of human optics.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Right. She assumes that photons bouncing off a fairy will chemically react with the silver halide crystals on a strip of Kodak film.
Which is a huge leap of faith, honestly.
It's an act of supreme mundane hubris.
Mundane hubris. I love that.
But I would argue her brilliance actually lies in her logistics, not necessarily her physics.
Okay, break that down for me.
Look at how she immediately breaks down the magic into a supply chain vulnerability.
Right, because she realizes she can't just drop this film off at the local photo lab.
Exactly. If she takes it to the lab, that same unenthusiastic teenage clerk is going to see the magical creatures.
And the mundane world will be completely exposed to the fey world.
So what does she do? She decides she has to learn to develop the film herself in the high school darkroom.
She's thinking three steps ahead.
She is. She asks about batteries and flashes, and when she realizes the gear is just way too expensive, she sets a hard operational parameter.
Daylight photography only.
Daylight only. She isn't treating magic like a mystical quest. She's treating it like an administrative bottleneck.
Which is just such a deeply human response to the unknown, right? We try to bureaucracy our way out of existential dread.
We really do.
But that whole administrative approach assumes the rules of the two worlds are static.
And they're definitely not static.
No, they are leaking. Which brings us to Tom and Eleanor's secret meeting.
Oh, up in the gnarly tree fort.
Yeah, Tom takes Eleanor up this makeshift dad-assisted pulley elevator into his treehouse.
Which is the perfect liminal space for this kind of revelation.
It really is. It's physically elevated, completely detached from the suburban ground rules down below.
And Tom is freaking out because he has just survived tracking a massive psychic white wolf to a portal.
The Siege of Wind,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
With the three circles of flattened grass.
That's the one. He knows this wolf belongs to House of December. And in response to his panic, Eleanor just calmly drops two massive pieces of lore.
Yeah, she introduces the epistemological framework of her reality.
The Fey Rule of Three.
Right. What I say three times is true. Let's really drill down into the mechanics of that rule.
Let's do it.
Because on the surface, it sounds like a standard fairy tale trope.
Oh, totally. Like Beetlejuice or something.
Yeah. But in Mirari, it functions like a brutal piece of software code.
It really does.
If a fae says something three times, it must be an objective, universal fact. They literally, physically cannot loop the statement a third time if it contains a falsehood.
But it's the inverse of the rule that makes it so dangerous.
Yes, because the logical inverse does not apply at all.
Exactly. If Eleanor says something twice and stops, it doesn't mean she is lying.
It just means she lacks absolute certainty.
Right. It's a system that forces the fae to weaponize omission.
That's so manipulative, though.
Well, if you are bound by a biological inability to tell an absolute lie three times, you have to become a master of the gray area.
You survive by manipulating what you don't say.
Precisely.
It's basically a legal loophole built into the physics of their universe.
And as wild as that psychological constraint is, it's really nothing compared to the causality loop they uncover next.
Oh, this part broke my brain.
Eleanor drops the bomb that Mirari discover Anakin because the kids' role-playing game echoed their land.
Her exact phrasing is, what you dreamed for us was real.
What you dreamed for us was real. The implications of that specific phrasing are just staggering.
Because Tom casually made up a faction called the Golden Hawks for their game.
And Eleanor confirms the Golden Hawks actually exist. They are a real historical military faction in Mirari.
Founded by a man named Lord Explorer Thomas, who vanished exactly 14 Mirari years ago.
And Tom, sitting right there in that treehouse, is 14 years old.
Okay, so we have to confront the biocentrism of this narrative. Did Tom's consciousness literally render the Mirari universe into existence?
That is a big question.
Like, every time he rolled a 20-sided die in his basement, was he writing the geopolitical history of a parallel dimension?
It's a terrifying thought.
Or, and this is the theory I personally lean toward, is Mirari emitting some kind of psychic frequency?
Ah, the antenna theory.
Yeah. Like, Tom's adolescent subconscious simply acted as an antenna, picking up the history of House October and House December and translating it into a game.
You know, if we look at it from Eleanor's perspective, the antenna theory actually holds a lot more weight.
You think so?
I do. Think about it. She belongs to House October. They are pacifists. They fundamentally value life.
Right. They might ransom an enemy, but they refuse to kill.
Exactly. Which puts them in stark contrast to the aggressive, wolf-aligned house December.
Right.
But Eleanor notes that she felt absolutely no intrinsic tether to Enochton or to Tom until she physically crossed over.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Right. If Tom was her literal creator, like the god of her universe, wouldn't she have felt some sort of metaphorical connection to him her entire life?
You would think so, yeah.
The fact that she didn't suggest they are two completely independent realities that have simply crashed into the same orbital path.
But imagine the sheer ontological shock of being Tom in that moment.
Oh, I'd lose my mind.
Right. You wrote a fantasy campaign, and today a girl is washing dishes in your kitchen telling you that your game is a documentary.
And that the monsters you invented are currently hunting you.
Most people would have a total psychological breakdown.
Which is precisely why Agatha's reaction to this overlapping reality is so vital to study.
Because she does the exact opposite of breaking down.
She does. While Tom is paralyzed by the existential weight of causality, Agatha just gets on her horse.
Destry, the black stallion.
Yes. She grabs a bag of sausage treats, takes her greyhound Kuan, and goes out to track the psychic wolf.
She shifts immediately from philosophical dread to tactical espionage.
It's amazing.
And the way she conducts this tracking operation, here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, lay it out.
She basically forces magic to submit to the scientific method.
Yes, she does.
Kuan picks up the wolf's scent near the woods, but he doesn't track it deeper into the magical wilderness.
No, he tracks it out toward Interstate 225.
Straight into the mundane suburban grid of Enochton. They go down Lyon Avenue, turn onto Lewis, and then the scent completely vanishes.
Right at the intersection of Dickinson Street.
The environmental contrast there is so jarring.
Oh, it's wild. You have this medieval archetype, a rider on a black stallion hunting a magical beast standing next to a suburban street lamp.
But look at her deductive process here. A lesser investigator would just say, well, it's a magic wolf. It teleported.
It vanished into thin air.
Right. But Agatha refuses to accept magic as an excuse for a break in logic.
She checks the corner storm drain.
Exactly. And she sees it's too small for a giant wolf to fit through.
So she deduces that if the conservation of mass still applies, the wolf didn't just vanish.
It either changed its physical form into a human, which would alter its scent, or it got into a motorized vehicle.
It's a flawless application of Occam's razor applied to the supernatural.
It really is.
She doesn't discard logic. She simply expands the parameters of logic to include shape-shifting.
I love that she even tries to interrogate the dog.
Oh, yeah.
She asks Kuan if he's just taking a shortcut. It's a very grounding, humorous moment. But it leads to the most chilling discovery of this entire deep dive.
The house.
The house. She looks across the street and sees a perfectly normal suburban house. But the door features an iron knocker shaped like a wolf's head.
And she memorizes the address. Now, combine that house with the physical den they find later near the Siege of Wind.
The shelter under the intertwined trees, full of white wolf fur.
Exactly. That fundamentally alters the geopolitical threat level here.
How's it?
Because this isn't a Narnia wardrobe scenario. It's not creatures stumbling through a portal, looking around and going back.
Right. They are commuting.
They are establishing a permanent intelligence network. House December has a resident agent operating out of a suburban house.
A literal sleeper cell.
A sleeper cell. It implies that fey creatures are actively adapting to human infrastructure.
Oh, man.
Like, if you take human form, do you have to pay property taxes?
Do you have to pretend to mow the lawn to avoid suspicion from the neighbors?
Exactly. The ancient magic is being constrained by the banality of a homeowners association.
That is hilarious, but also terrifying. Because it means the bleeding of these worlds isn't just an accident of physics.
It's an act of colonization.
House December is running a long-term operation. And to truly understand the paranoia driving that operation, we have to look at the other side.
Merari.
Yes. Because while Agatha is in Enochton trying to use a camera to capture magic, the inhabitants of the magical world are attempting the exact same thing in reverse.
Right. The grand finale at Hawksmoor Keep.
The setting there is the quintessential dark fantasy stronghold.
It's this elevated fortress bordering a terrifying inky black forest.
And they are being hunted by the Drew.
These malicious, shadowy entities that you only ever perceive as darting movements and escalating growls.
The atmosphere is just completely saturated with paranoia.
You have this heavily armed party preparing for a brutal physical conflict. Lord Explorer Thomas is in tightly linked chainmail.
Lady Redmayne has her breastplate. Princess Angel is choosing a fur-lined cloak.
And Lady Raven, the Oracle, is right beside them. They are geared up for medieval warfare.
But the weapon they believe will give them the ultimate tactical advantage against these shadows, it isn't a sword.
No, it's an artifact Lady Redmayne procured from the quote-unquote other side.
Artifact she calls an opticon, forged by the great wizard Kodak.
Kodak.
It is the exact same manual camera Agatha purchased at the drugstore.
It is. And the way Lady Redmayne explains the magical constraints of this object to the other knights, it is just a masterclass in cultural framing.
She is deadly serious about the arcane rules required to operate it.
Oh, completely serious.
She explains it holds exactly 24 charges, meaning a standard 24 exposure roll of film.
She warns them that it requires ambient daylight to function.
And that the results of the spell won't be visible until a complex, quote, alchemical process is performed later.
And then the young knight, Sir Liphalon, he is practically trembling when he asks if the artifact requires a dark incantation to activate.
And Redmayne replies that yes, sometimes a magic word is invoked, though she isn't sure it's strictly necessary.
And she says the invocation is say cheese.
Wait, say cheese. Like, literally say cheese.
Literally say cheese.
That is just incredible. It's hilarious, but beneath the humor, there is a terrifying philosophical proposition there.
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
right.
Arthur C. Clarke famously said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah, classic sci-fi rule.
What Murari proves is the exact inverse.
Any sufficiently mundane technology, when stripped of its cultural context, is instantly classified as a system of arcane rules.
The irony is profound. Think about it. Agatha empties her savings to buy a Kodak camera in Enochton because she believes it is an opticon.
A mystical tool capable of capturing the supernatural.
Meanwhile, hardened knights in Hawksmoor Keep revere the exact same piece of plastic and glass, believing it is a mystical tool capable of capturing reality.
They are both placing blind faith in a mechanism they do not understand, simply because it originates from a world they cannot comprehend.
Exactly. But let's look at the mechanics of the test they run, because this is where the physics of the two worlds violently clash.
Right. They need to test the camera before they actually go hunt the Drew.
So Lady Raven, using her natural magic, casts a glamour.
She drops her human disguise and reveals her true form, which is this towering, dark-skinned fawn with antlers.
Which is the natural state of Lord October, for context.
Right. And the knight's reaction is totally visceral.
Redmayne shouts an alarm. Selifalin nearly draws his sword to defend the princess.
He completely forgets it's an illusion. It is a moment of genuine terror.
And then Lord Thomas steps up.
Yeah.
He looks through the viewfinder, sees the blurred, overlapping image of the human woman and the towering fawn.
And he presses the shutter.
The mechanical click echoes through the stone fortress. Thomas advances the film dial like he's disarming a bomb.
But I have to ask, what is that camera actually capturing?
That is the ambiguity that drives all of this.
Right. Does the film capture the true underlying reality of the fae creature? Like, does it penetrate the magic?
Or does the film simply record the photons that the magical illusion is bending?
Exactly. If magic can trick the human eye, why couldn't it trick a silver halide chemical reaction?
And they don't know. They don't know if the technology works on magic any more than Agatha knows if it works on fairies.
They are trying to map a new territory using a cartography system designed for a completely different planet.
It's a recipe for paranoia. And while all of this grand, noisy experimentation is happening, the source material slips in this tiny, brilliant detail.
Oh, the lizard.
Yes. Down by the pulley ropes of the fortress elevator, a small, grayish lizard is watching them.
When the fawn illusion drops, the lizard peeks its black eye around the brickwork, silently observing the entire test.
Lord Thomas notices it and actually wonders, just for a split second, if the lizard is a spy.
Which brings this entire deep dive full circle.
It really does.
In Enochton, Agatha and Tom are being surveilled by a psychic white wolf disguised as a neighborhood dog.
And in Murari, the knights are being surveilled by a lizard lingering near an elevator.
The paranoia is entirely mutual.
Both realities are locked in a cold war of espionage. They are desperately trying to reverse engineer the rules of the other side before they are destroyed by them.
It perfectly illustrates the observer effect, doesn't it?
Completely. The moment Enochton and Murari became aware of one another, they began altering each other's behavior.
The mundanity of the suburbs is forcing fey magic to operate out of street corner safe houses.
And the magic of Murari is forcing suburban kids to treat Kodak cameras like weapons of mass observation.
So what does this all mean when we look at all these sources together?
It means that the meaning of these objects, the heavy silver, the camera, the tabletop miniatures, It isn't baked into the atoms of the objects themselves.
The power is entirely assigned by the user's belief system.
A fork is just a fork until you believe it belongs in a museum.
And a camera is just a camera until you believe it can capture a soul.
Which leaves us with a necessary and perhaps uncomfortable question to examine in our own lives.
Okay, hit us with it.
Well, we've just dissected how the rigid, absolute rules of a parallel universe were entirely dictated by the casual imaginations of teenagers rolling dice in a basement.
The boundary between the fictional game and the objective reality was completely porous.
Exactly. So as you go through your own day, interacting with the systems that govern your life, the corporate ladders, the social hierarchies, the financial metrics you stress over.
The rules we all blindly follow.
Right. How much of your daily reality is composed of absolute objective truths? And how much of it is just an intricate, exhausting game that you've simply forgotten you are playing?
Wow. That is a question worth holding on to the next time you feel completely bound by the rules of your environment.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining us as we mapped the bleeding edges of Annington and Murari. We challenge you to look a little closer at the mundane artifacts sitting on your own kitchen counter today.
Strip away the context and you might just realize how much magic you're already holding.
Keep questioning the rules and keep diving deep.